problem of domestic violence is endemic in this country. But how do we stop it? Today, the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, pledged $328 million to combat the problem. Natasha Stott-Despoja is a former senator and is the founding chair of Our Watch. She's just launched her new book on violence, and I spoke to her a little earlier. I began by asking her why she decided to write about this topic.
Well, my work these days is all about violence, or specifically preventing violence against women and their children through chairing Our Watch. One thing I've noticed, though, in the last few months, and I know there's been some high-profile domestic and family violence cases and some awful cases of sexual assault and death, but people are coming up to me saying, what can I do? How can I get involved? And I genuinely believe people want to see things change. We're all sick of the death toll, the statistics, the literal body count. So I thought, why not try and put on paper some ideas for stopping the violence before it occurs?
The Prime Minister has today pledged $328 million in a national strategy on domestic violence and family violence. Yesterday, Labor made an announcement and they've made other announcements. I feel like we're in a kind of bidding war at the moment on this issue.
If you're going to have a bidding war about any topic that affects your nation, well, this is the one. It affects us economically, it affects us socially, obviously in humanitarian terms, there's an extraordinary cost for our nation. So it's time that legislators were not only putting resources and putting in place good policies, and we do have some very good ones that we can build on through the national plans, but they need to ensure that they're personally committed. And today, some of the comments from the Prime Minister were encouraging for me, especially where he linked, you know, disrespect for women with the issue of violence. That's an important step by this Prime Minister, but it's one that I want all policymakers, legislators and leaders to embrace. And I'd also like them to model some of these respectful relationship behaviours themselves, just quietly.
Okay, let's go to that, because you say it all starts with the disrespect of women. It doesn't all lead to violence. And
indeed,
it's something that Malcolm Turnbull often said as well, the previous Prime Minister.
Indeed.
But what kind of different behaviours do the politicians need to show that you think could actually have make a difference here?
Well, we know, and all the evidence is clear, internationally and otherwise, that there is a link between gender inequality and indeed violence against women. So you've got to look at those disrespectful behaviours. So whether that's in our parliaments, everything from so-called slut-shaming to the way women are portrayed, scrutinised according to their appearance, their marital status, you name it. It may even be those sexist jokes that we hear in society generally. These kind of insults or trivialisations, these behaviours and attitudes actually give rise to violence in the first place. So if we start to tackle some of these issues, some of those rigid gender stereotypes, a lack of independence and control for women, and indeed make sure that women are represented in some of our most powerful institutions, that all adds up to a society that's more equal and thus more respectful and hopefully safer.
To the Prime Minister's package, $328 million, it's to combat domestic violence through frontline services, also safe places and prevention strategies. Are you satisfied with that commitment? Labor has been positive but says essentially it's a continuation of funding.
Well, firstly, I'm not across the detail because it's only come out today, so I've got a lack of specificity in terms of the funding. But what I have seen, and something that I'm excited by, is what seems to be one of the largest ever investments in prevention. So primary prevention, stopping the violence before it occurs. That's around $68 million, I believe. And that will represent one of the largest investments in prevention ever, whether that's through, you know, respectful relationships, education or other opportunities. But certainly the issue of services and intervention, we can't afford to ignore that. That may be a continuation of what's existed previously. I'll see what's in the detail. But I know that this announcement, as indeed our national action plans, have been informed by important consultations with the sector and the broader community. So I think the knowledge is there. It just needs the political goodwill attached to it.
In your book on violence, you talk about the alacrity with which our leaders respond to acts of terrorism and one-punch incidents. It provides a stark contrast to how we deal with family violence or sexual assault. We're hearing different language now. We've talked about it, the Prime Minister, the opposition leader. But do you still think these issues are dealt with too differently?
I do think they're dealt with differently, and I think the contrast last year, which, yes, I refer to in the essay, that sense of an extraordinary grief-stricken time for our nation where you had around 11 women dying violently in something like a 22-day period. And yet, albeit cowardly and awful, attack on the strawberry sector actually received or garnered more response and more attention than some of these other issues. Now, I don't mean to trivialise either of those issues, but I think a lot of our leaders have failed to realise that this is something that is attacking the very core of our nation, that people are dying, women and children are dying, and it's time to take action. So I think that without meaning to trivialise issues, of course, you know, terrorism and other awful, you know, cowardly and other acts, I do feel that we haven't had appropriate responses, and I don't think we've given the same measure of importance to the issue of family violence, sexual violence in our community.
Let's talk about the backlash. Mm-hmm. Why do you think we're seeing a backlash to talking about male violence, and how important is that to deal with so that we really can work together in a unified way rather than, you know, retreating to our own little patches of ideology and views?
Well, first of all, we need to work together. Men, women, boys and girls. All sectors have a role, not just government, obviously the corporate sector, the community sector. When we work together, we're going to be best at this. But there's no room for people, and particularly some sections of the male community, to get offended by these discussions. That's what the backlash encompasses. You know, when people say, but it's not all men. Of course, it's not all men. But we all play a part in changing attitudes and behaviours, recognising they're not linear in a community. We can all play a part in stopping, you know, measures of disrespect as we've seen them. But certainly the backlash is real. 'Twas ever thus. I think women particularly, or advocates, male or female, who speak out against male violence, has found that people sometimes take offence. My idea is to try and make the debate accessible, you know, readable, hopefully a bit conversational, but at the same time, never ever underestimate the fact that gender has an influence on this issue. Violence, whoever perpetrates it, is bad, but the reality is women are more likely to be a victim of sexual and family violence than men.
We talked about the bidding war before, and you said, yes, it's true, we're seeing this scenario I don't think we've ever seen before. Well, I certainly haven't seen it before in the 20 years I've been watching politics. Do you hope it becomes an election issue? I mean, we want bipartisanship. Everyone talks about the importance of bipartisanship, but by making it an election issue, does it put it in the spotlight?
I think there's no doubt that it is an election issue. An announcement yesterday by the Leader of the Opposition, a funding package today, it's on the agenda. And if there's a bidding war, as you say, or someone described it to me earlier as an arms race, well then so be it. But as long as the strategies, the policies and the resources are going to do what we need them to do, we must invest in services, intervention and these other programs, secondary, tertiary efforts, but primary prevention needs attention too. So if it means support for these areas, that's great. But if it means community awareness and community action, that's even better. That's what I want, education and change.
The Prime Minister has entered the debate on cracking down on NRL players off-field, and he's been quite strong on this today. What do you make of those off-field indiscretions, these acts we've seen? It's in the spotlight again today. Very strong language from the Prime Minister and political leaders. Yes. Is that the kind of language we finally have been waiting for or need?
Patricia, it's exactly what we've been waiting for. And isn't it interesting how I think the community is reacting to that with a bit of relief and also being educated too, thinking, yes, actually, that's not acceptable in any workplace, let alone a sporting code. I never underestimate the power of sportsmen and women as role models. In fact, they're so influential, apart from parents and maybe teachers, but sports people, those champions. So if they model respectful and ethical behaviour, we are winning. And I hope that codes will recognise that changing the culture within their clubs, their workplaces, is as important as what they do on the sporting field.
And just a final personal, on a personal note, you write in the book that you're often seen as the ambitious deputy leader. How is that word being used a negative? Why is it a negative? Why did you feel like it was being used as a negative?
Well, I think ambition for change is never a negative thing. In the book, I refer to some experiences I had many years ago, because it's a long time since I was in federal parliament, certainly a long time since I was deputy leader of the Democrats. but just showing how we use words to describe men and women and boys and girls differently. And that was always used often in a, you know, pejorative way, in the same way that sometimes women in public life or in politics in particular are described as shrill or strident when they're merely being as assertive as their male counterparts. So we've got a long way to go, and that's a message for parents, teachers and role models. The messages we send boys and girls from the moment they're born, it's so influential. It matters.
Just on a final note as well on that, see, I'm being a bit sneaky here, yep. But today we're having a discussion again about quotas in the Liberal Party for women. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that discussion as you watch it unfold? Of course, you're formerly in the Democrats. You're not in the Liberal Party. But we've watched this unfold. Should the Liberal Party implement quotas?
Well, I care about women in politics generally. So I feel like it's Groundhog Day, isn't it? Haven't we been talking about quotas for years? I remember when I used to talk about it before I even got into Parliament, and people were worried that, oh, women wouldn't get there on merit. Well, clearly, there are meritorious women everywhere, and we've got men scurrying out the back door from their parliamentary seats. If they really believe in refreshing Parliament, start handing the baton to those talented women who we know exist. So I'm feeling a bit old and, you know, exhausted by this debate, because isn't it time we had parity, gender parity, in our decision-making institutions, especially our federal parliament? So yes, if it takes quotas, bring it on. But surely, surely these men and women should be able to pre-select talented women who can help change and shape our nation for the better.
Natasha Stott-Despoja, thanks for coming in.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Natasha Stott-Despoja is a former senator and is the founding chair of Our Watch. Her new book on violence was launched today. And this is RN Drive.